Well, good afternoon. First, I'm not sure everybody knows everybody. I think we should do introductions around. You want to start?
I'm Connie.
I'm John.
Judy.
Lian.
Yoshi.
Randy.
Free.
Ellie.
John.
John. Where's John?
Falling down.
Two Johns. So, since my focus has been on Blanche, I thought I would share Blanche with you this afternoon. She was, for me, a mentor. I was a very reluctant student for her. She had to beg me 3 times to go with her to Japan. Can you imagine? But she also became a very dear friend and a wonderful teacher. And her life was so exemplary in so many ways for us. She was so frank and open about herself and her life. She was so honest. She was she started out as a chemist and as a very stylish woman, and she was married to a very stylish man. There's a marvelous picture of them walking down the sidewalk in San Francisco, dressed to the nines, she in a beautiful suit and gloves and a hat and high heels, and looking just great on his arm. And he looked natty as anything. Just beautiful picture. He was a radio announcer. He had his own radio program for years. And they had 4 children, and life went on for them until she got involved in, she was always very political in those days and very radically on the left. Her dad was kicked out of the university where he was teaching in Alabama because he was, if he wasn't a communist, he was practically one. And in Alabama back in those days, that was not a good thing. So she was at a demonstration at San Francisco State. And all the students were pushing against the police line. And the police were all pushing back. And she was at the front of the line pushing against the police. And her all dressed up, you know, during lunch hour she came to do this thing. And the police were there in their riot gear with these big helmets on and all this stuff and all these guns and everything. And so they were really angry and pushing, and she was looking into this face, and the face looked back. And she was stunned as they saw each other. And she knew something had happened, and she didn't know what it was. But she started looking and looking and asking, what was this thing that had happened? And she looked into the eyes of this person, and he looked back. So eventually she met Suzuki Roshi over in Berkeley and heard him speak, and she thought, that's what I've been looking for. Which is exactly what I thought when I was at Tassajara the very first time and heard him speak. And I thought, I've been looking all my life for this. So nice. She she did what she and everybody thought was a very naughty thing, and left her family and went to Tassajara to practice. Just abandoned the kids. And it caused great turmoil in the family. It was very difficult for them. There was one daughter that took years to forgive her. She had to go. And she became the mechanic. She was the one who fixed all the trucks and the cars that took people up and down that terrible road. And one day, somebody new came to teach, and it was a sewing teacher from Japan who brought Koto Sawaki's way of sewing things like this and big ones. And she got totally intrigued and realized that that was her way. That there was, she just was going to do this sewing for the rest of her life. And she did. She did all the way to the end. It's extremely meticulous work. As some of you know, you take refuge with Buddha with every single stitch. Namukie Butsu, plunging into the ocean of Buddha. And she was very strict about the way she taught sewing. She always had the offering of incense and the three bows and then the seed, and it mostly starts out quiet and then sort of more talking toward the end, and then more quiet as it ended with more bows. So it was a ceremony all by itself of sewing, and she made it what it is, sewing Buddha's robe. And she taught about it. She made sure that people understood it wasn't something you had or you owned. It was something that was an embrace in a way. It was like we say in the robe chant that it's Buddha's robe. It's far beyond form and emptiness. We wear the Tathagata's teaching to save all sentient beings. So it's not about us at all. And she exemplified that. She became the abbess of San Francisco Zen Center. The only abbess in the USA, or in many other places either. There are very few in Japan left anymore. It was a very radical and amazing thing when she took that seat. And she changed San Francisco Zen Center immensely, immensely. It was extremely zen-y. When I first knew it, it was like walking into a refrigerator. They were all in black, and they were all upright, and they tucked their chins, and they walked around like this, and nobody smiled, and nobody looked at anybody. You just felt like you were in some sort of, it was very uncomfortable. And she broke all of that. She made it warm and friendly, and she was extremely strict. She could be really harsh if you didn't do the forms right, but underneath she had a big grandma heart, and she took care of everybody in a wonderful way. she did a very gutsy thing at one point, which is how I got to know her. First she came to Jikoji after she had received her brown robe and been transmitted. And she decided that she was going to sit with various other places and see how they did it. And her first choice was to see how Koban did it, because Koban always was considered to be sort of a flake, sort of a too casual and too soft and too all of those things. And she thought so too. She always thought he didn't teach the how to do things the proper way. So she came to clap her eye on us as we sat sesshin. And she happened to be there when I received the brown robe in a very peculiar ceremony. I had no idea about it. I had given the robe after I'd sewn it. 3 years earlier, I'd sewn the robe with Blanche at Green Gulch and then given it to Koban, and he was going to give it to me sometime. And 3 years later, we were sitting sesshin, and somebody came whose grandma had just died and asked Koban to do a memorial service for her. So Koban gathered us all together and set up the altar in a new place and did the ceremony. And at the end, he called Blanche up and called me up. And he brought out the brown robe and put it on my head. And we chanted the Dai Sai 3 times. And then they both helped me put it on. And afterwards, Blanche went home bewildered. She really didn't know what she had seen and what that was all about. She just thought that was the weirdest thing. So she went to Koban and asked him about it. She said, "What the heck were you doing there?" And he said, "It's a lay priest ordination and transmission. And Dogen said we could do that." And Dogen does, actually. Their lay transmission is perfectly possible and was often done in Japan. Dogen himself had several lay priest women who practiced with him. So she became interested in my fate. She was worried about me because she could see I didn't know anything. Koban wouldn't teach anything to me. The few things he ever did were so hard to pick up. You had to watch him. It was a very Japanese way. It's how he learned archery. His teacher never told him anything. He just had to be there and watch. So he once took me all the way up to Humboldt County and asked me to help him do a wedding. The wedding was in a restaurant, and the bride and groom and Koban and I sat in this little booth with a table in front of us and the flowers right in front of us and the incense, and then the audience back in the rest of the room. And I watched him give the precepts to the bride and groom right there in the booth. And that was my lesson in how to do a wedding. So it was like that. And so she invited me to go to Japan with her. And I said, "Oh, I can't. I have all these commitments. I'm doing all these things, and I have a husband, and I don't think I had known." The children were gone by then, but they were just gone. And I didn't feel comfortable just up and leaving for a month. So I said no. And I said no 2 times. And the third time, I realized that I couldn't say no anymore. I had to go. And she took 11 of us, women, from the Bay Area, most of them from Suzuki Roshi's lineage. I was the only Koban person there, representing something as I began to realize I was sort of teaching Koban's way to this other sort of practice. And she was going to teach us all the forms at Suzuki Roshi's temple in Yaizu, outside of Shizuoka in Japan. Beautiful little fishing village, Yaizu. And then it was about a 20 or 25 minute walk to get to the temple from there. Beautiful, very old temple with a Buddha hall, and then the Zendo, and then the family lived over here in the house. So, and then there was a kiln up on the hill behind the house, just before the cemetery. It was, and then the hill just kept on going and going, and they were growing tea up there all around. Very, very beautiful place. They took us the first day into the Buddha hall, and the first thing was they said, "Do you know what it looks like at the foot of the stairs where you left your shoes?" And we said no, and they took us out to look at them, and the shoes were all over the place, just scattered. They said, "You can't be here like that. You've got to pay attention to what you're doing. At least line up your shoes so you can find them when you come out." And then he took us in, and I thought, okay, finally I'm going to learn some of the forms. And Suzuki Roshi's son, also Suzuki Roshi, called that. And a monk from Sojiji, which is the other great temple, there's Eheiji and Sojiji. They're both from the Dogen lineage. So there were those two guys and Blanche. And they were the three. They were all going to help us learn the forms. So they had this huge, big brass bell and this huge mokugyo with a big boom, boom, boom. And they set us to go with them. So they said, "All right, now hold this and you can do the bell like this." And then another one of them would say, "No, it's not like that at all. You do it like this." "Oh, we didn't learn it that way. And so, Gigi, we do it another way." And they went around and around, all three of them, because they each had a different tradition in the same tradition. And I thought, Koban was right. They're all making it up. It was such a relief. So I carefully tried to learn all those forms. So I was very shaky, just like Uchiyama Roshi had confessed that he never felt comfortable doing those things. He always was shaky. And Kodo Sawaki told him he didn't have to. He said, "Just forget about it. It's not important." But Koban thought it was important. He thought that kind of very careful attention. You remember just how... And I told Blanche once that Koban, when he took the incense, always broke a tiny piece off the bottom, so it was more likely to stay upright as it went into the ash. And she just thought that was so fabulous. It was one more little thing that she just loved so much. I learned so much from her. And when we came back from Japan, after a very interesting trip, we really bonded, us 12 women, really bonded. Sometimes we would have a day off and pile into several cars and become what Grace Shireson called shopping nuns from hell. She was really into shopping. We had to go to the shops no matter what. She bought some incredibly beautiful things. When we came back, we began to see each other a couple of times a year for the first 5 or 10 years. And now it's just once a year. But we always get together. And we have a date for the end of May because we wanted to celebrate Blanche's birthday, which is on the 5th of May, and celebrate with her. So we're missing that. We're going to end up at her funeral instead, which is a shame, but not tragic. She was plenty ready to go, and it was time. So it's one of those very, very sad situations that aren't tragic at all. In fact, they're not even really sad. She wasn't that kind of person. So the announcement they sent out, her family sent it out to everybody, and it was so like that part of her. Our beloved mother, teacher, abbess, and friend, Zenke Blanche Hartman, took her last breath at 12:30 a.m. That was yesterday. She was 90 years and 5 days old. She died at ease, peaceful, and with joy. According to her wishes, we chanted the full moon ceremony. She will be at Zen Center for 3 days, so all may come and sit with her. Her name means inconceivable joy. So the pictures on the altar, I thought, were perfect because one is her very stern monk-like self, and she could be very, very stern. And the other on the cover of her book, which I hope you all have a chance to see because it's a lovely book. It's just little bits of most of her talks. I mean, bits of talks and then a few full talks. In her most penetrating and compassionate way, but the picture is this big, just huge, joyful face of Buddha nature, you could say. It's lovely. So that's what I brought to say. And there's time for questions, comments, rememberings. Bree.
So that's such a touching story, and I'm just curious because I'm not actually that familiar with the history, even of American women in Zen. But it sounds like she must have been very instrumental to have brought, you say, 10 or 12 or 13 of you to Japan, all women. So was that just kind of part of her vision?
Absolutely. That was part of her vision. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was determined to ordain women and to teach them and to make sure that they had a place because she could see what the men had done. They just turned the thing into a refrigerator. Mm-hmm. It's no good at all. Mm-hmm. It was inhuman. Mm-hmm. They just didn't get the teaching. They didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were so lucky that she made the way for us, and Coben did too. And that was one of the things that they thought badly of Coben, because he privileged women as much as he did men. Oh, not quite as, not the way that he did men, actually. As women progressed in the teaching and in the study, he told several people that he didn't know what to do with us. There's a real intimacy that grows up between a teacher and a student, and it gets tricky between a man and a woman. And it's not impossible. I know it's not impossible, but he was a little confused about sexuality, I think, so it became a problem for him. He was so monkish too long, and so when he got free, he didn't know quite how to deal with it.
What do you mean exactly? Like, did he wind up sleeping with his students?
Yes. Not all of them, just one. They had an open marriage, his first marriage, and so he did sleep with one of the students, and it created a tremendous, in fact, that's what caused the breakup of the marriage. Although she thought they should have an open marriage, which is what happened to the open marriages mostly, when it comes down to it. No, let's not do that.
Not very practical.
Oh, it doesn't feel good.
It's hard to deal with emotionally.
Yes, yes.
If you're programmed that way.
Well, if you make a commitment, you expect the commitment to be mutual. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
Even going into a relationship that you know is going to be open, it's hard to do.
Yeah, it's unrealistic. We don't operate that way.
Some faiths do, and successfully, they give Mormons.
Well, that's not success.
Like some cultures, you could have more than one wife.
Yeah, she's saying the Mormons do.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But
they've been doing that in India for thousands of years.
Yes, and it's a patriarchal situation where the men are driving the women into the ground.
It's a commit. Yeah, but still, it's a commitment. It's not this flaky thing. So,
yeah,
it's still being a marriage.
Yes, but a different kind of marriage. Yeah, he had three wives. So, as I say, sexuality for him was a confused situation, which meant that we had to be... I never felt I had to be careful. I never had a problem that way at all. But I was very committed to my family, and he meant for me to be committed to my family. He supported my husband and took my kids skiing and just made sure it was all a family thing that was happening. And I wanted to go to Tassajara, and there was no way he was going to let me go to Tassajara. So I just sort of picked it up as a housewife. When I left Chikoji, finally, and there was a little ceremony in the Zendo, and one of the things he said, and the only reason that anybody knew that I was transmitted, quote unquote, was because he said, "I never knew there was such a thing as a transmitted housewife before you came along." And I was so mad. I thought, I'm not a housewife. Of course I was.
It's called a backhanded compliment or something?
I guess so. I don't know. I don't know. He was just... But it was... That part was difficult, actually. It was... It was difficult, and it was just the right thing, as it turned out. But it was certainly painful at the time. He did not make it easy. It was kind of like being kicked out, which happens sometimes. And fortunately, some years later, I heard that he was leading a session in Austria, and one of my sons was married to an Austrian and living there, and we decided we would go, my husband and I, and go and visit them. And I thought, if I'm going to Vienna, I'm going to go to Poreg, which was a whole day's train ride away, and see Koben and sit the session. So I did that. And when I first came, you have to hike into the, it's on a mountain, and you get dropped off by the bus, and then you hike in with your backpack on. And Koben was standing right outside the house, and he saw me and looked like that, and then he turned his back. And I thought, oh, darn. Still in the soup. But then I just sat the session. They gave me a place to sleep in the Zendo, which I love. And I had to leave finally because my family was expecting me, so I went to say goodbye. And he brought out a rakusu that I had made. I should have brought that one. This is a different one. A brown one, because I had the brown robe, but I didn't have the brown rakusu. So I made one myself, just for myself. But I needed him to write on the back of it, so I dropped it off at his house several years before and never heard a word. But he brought it out. He had it with him. And he said, sit down, and he sat down at this little table and brought out his ink and a brush, and he sat there and he wrote the most beautiful calligraphy on the back of it, just boom, like that, just as if it, and he put it on my head, and we did the Daizai and said goodbye. And on the way out he said, someday my brother's son will be coming to lead session here, but if he can't come, you should come and lead session here. And I thought, oh my God. What?
Wow.
So, yeah. It was that way all the way through. So, of course, I did. You know, I don't think Bune ever went there. But I went many times to Poreg and did wonderful sessions. Anything else? Ellie?
I didn't really know Koben, but one of my favorite little stories that you've taught, there are many, but just the one about when you take your shoes off to go in, have them pointing out, so in case you need to rush out and help somebody, they're ready to go.
Yes. He said his master told him that because in the war, you have to be ready if there's an air raid. You know, so you should be ready to leap up and into your shoes.
I know that part.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He was very affected by the Second World War. All those teachers were.
I can imagine. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, they came and demanded of his teacher, his old master, books from his library that they thought were Western. You know, he loved Western things. When we went to visit him, I took the kids to Japan at a certain point when the oldest son ended up there. Koban sent him there because he didn't know what else to do with his life at the age of 19. So Koban said, "Oh, you would love my country." And Chris ended up at the family temple and often visiting Koban's old master. So now I'm losing my train of thought. That's what remembering things does.
Well, the war, the impact.
Oh, the war, and he had all these Western books, and when we visited, he played Beethoven for us after dinner. He wanted to show his favorite music. So they were going to take the books, and he refused to let them. He just said no. And he was this big guy with a deep, deep voice, and his practice with chanting. So his teaching of Koban was all chanting practice. And when people from Koban's students went to be with him, they would stay at the family temple and then go visit the old master and join him in chanting, because that's how he did it for long periods instead of zazen.
This is a story just comes up about Blanche. I did Chisso in the 80s, and he sprang it on me, and I wasn't ready for it. I pleaded with him to get out of it. I couldn't, of course. And during the Chisso group, I'd be peppered with questions. And Blanche and Lou were there.
Oh, my gosh.
And I had never seen them before. I saw them up in San Francisco. We're never down in Jacoby. I was really quaking my boots at this point. The Koban's bringing in ringers here. I'm going to be nailed. So there were a lot of questioning, though. I came to Blanche. She was deep and soft at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very gentle. Moved. I was very uncomfortable up here. And it was just remarkable. I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
How gentle and easy she was, except the questions were quite powerful.
Mm-hmm.
But it was okay.
Yes.
Because of her mannerisms, it was just wonderful.
Yes.
So to speak.
That's how it was. We were on the train one time, and there was a woman with a baby crying, and we couldn't sit down. This is in Japan. We were all standing in the aisle. The train was racketing along and the baby was crying, and Blanche just reached over and took the baby and held it, quieted it down. Just like that.
Yeah. That would be something, a gaijin, taking your baby.
Right.
Taking your baby.
Well, she looked like a priest.
Oh,
so.
Okay. She had the right clothes.
She had the right clothes. Yoshi?
It's amazing to hear how Blanche shifted the air at the center.
Yes.
And then I would like to get some advice. I am going into this group over and over, and I just feel they don't want to look at my face.
Mm.
You know, some people, you know, maybe that's it, or not even, like people. I just feel so alienated, and I feel so people aloof, and I cannot relate. And so when I heard that fact, okay, the way I feel may not be wrong. You know?
Yes.
So,
yes.
Like, often I blame myself. I shouldn't make a judgment. But I just feel so, cannot connect. And I feel lonely. And I feel, when I come to your Sangha, I just feel too much.
Yeah.
So I'd like to get some advice how I would behave.
Well, if that's the culture, you're stuck with it. Unless you become the abbess. You know? she could make a lot of changes, but if you're just a student, it's pretty hard to make a difference. Except your own feeling and attitude while you're there, the more loving and more interested you are in other people, the more they'll be interested and trusting of you. So in a situation like that, it's hard to depend on others to break that lack of connection. And it eases things if you can find a way to reach out.
Reach out within?
Reach out to others. Just be interested in them and get to know them.
You could be the change that you want to see.
Exactly. Thank you, John.
You could be the change that you want to see. So you yourself can... I wish it was more this way. You yourself can...
Be
that
like
way,
that.
And that may have an influence on other
so
people.
So the one I shared with you,
mm-hmm.
like taking an action, I'll see how people respond.
Yes.
There mm-hmm. may not be a response. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well, if they care for the man, they will want to help him. Yeah. Tell people what you want to do. Can you share that? Situation?
I already spoke up to one person.
I mean here.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I am an acupuncturist and I've been dealing with one of the Sangha members who got cancer and it's metastasized to the bone. He's in pain, I've been suffering. And I'm not a very frequent member of this group. That he is. So I had a dilemma, like I cannot share the confidentiality, right? But I wanted to get the help because mm-hmm. I felt helpless. So I talked to one leading woman. Actually, she's pretty new and I think I can go to the group because of her. And then I said, I need help and I maybe if some people are interested in cooking, I would like to form a small group to start cooking some stuff that he can ingest and get more strength. Mm-hmm. So I am not really a constant member, so I was not sure how people would respond. But next Monday, or either this woman is going to make a request to the group. Of course, with this guy, he said he agreed that it's okay to share his condition with the group. So first of all, I talked to him and he said it's fine. So he already attended this core members meeting and I heard he shared his experience. So I had no idea what kind of relationship on a personal level in his world, how he was related to this group. So so I hope I can start something for him.
Well, that's the first step. You already took it. Yeah. cool? Judy?
So, in your story, you said that you wanted very much to go to Tassajara. Mm-hmm. Was that to study under Suzuki Roshi?
I just wanted the experience. I didn't need another teacher, but I needed I thought I needed the experience of a practice period, of just practicing Zen and nothing else. But because I wasn't allowed to do that, I realized, which is, of course, the whole point anyway, that I had to practice right where I was. So it was a great gift not to have to go. And I'm very wary of advising anybody to go to Tassajara, although I gave John recommendations.
I was going anyway. I was going anyway. I said, God, if Coben's dead, God, who could I get to write this? Michael, no, Michael sort of has an in for, he has a negative thing about me. Okay, and he's the priest that you go through. Now, Angie, yeah, I can ask Angie. And it was easy. She wrote me a letter, wow! She was Santa Claus.
I was glad to do it. But mostly I'm very hesitant to do that. As I think for most people, it's not necessary.
If you can do it, it's a wonderful thing to do.
Yes, I know. And sometimes I wish I could.
Plus
could have done it.
You can dispel all of the ideas that you had about it by finally having done it.
Yes.
And about half of them will be totally false, and half of them will be, oh, yeah, great, it's even better than I thought.
Well, and you dispel a lot of ideas about yourself. But life does that to us anyway, you know, especially if we do have a sitting practice. A serious sitting practice, and allow ourselves to be beat up by life the way it does to us, and just see our way into it and through it. It's really important because we're going to die. And this whole subject of lightness and darkness and Sandokai is all about our situation. This life in this hard-edged world like this is permeated and sustained in another way. That we can realize as we sit. And that realization itself is what can carry us through this life and into death. And it can offer us the opportunity to connect the way Blanche connected with the policeman, to actually be available enough to be able to look into someone else's eyes and be looked at. So it's what, without that, we have too many ideas and judgments about other people, too many ideas and judgments about ourselves. So the practice is for this, if it has a reason, we always say there's no reason, we just do it. But if it has a reason, this is why. It's not for us, it's for the whole of it. All of it. Well, that's a good way to end. Thank you ever so much.